John Schwartz said he wanted me to give a benediction. I asked him if it had to be in Latin or whether I should wear ecclesiastical garb. I've decided just to take up a collection instead. It's a new fundraising mechanism that we've got to get used to. I asked Dana what I should say. She said, tell a few funny stories. Put this in context. Well, I've got to tell you, I don't have any funny stories. My whole life has been a series of tragedies, things not turning out as I expected them to. How many of you have been managers in this system or NPR staff for, let's say, 20 years or more? Great. 10 years or more? Okay, let me see if I can give you a little history of how we got to where we are, because there are some interesting distinct steps. And along the way, I'm going to tell you a few of the things that affected my thinking about radio. As I told you, it's a series of tragedies. My first memory of radio was at about age 4. There was a guy on the radio by the name of Gabriel Heater. Does anybody remember him? Yeah, he was sponsored by a company called Kreml Hair Tonic, K-R-E-M-L, Kreml Hair Tonic. My father had snow white hair. Think of a big Irishman that looked like Kevin Close. And on the advice of Gabriel Heater, my father tried Kreml Hair Tonic. It turned his hair bright yellow. He was about to throw the radio through the window. Fortunately, it was one of those big floor-mounted Philcos. First example of my contact with radio and my experience of things not turning out quite as I had expected them, or someone else had expected them, I guess. Well, along about the time I got to be in high school, somebody said, what are you going to be? It had never occurred to me that you had to be something. All I knew was that my parents had lost all of their money in the Depression, and I didn't want to be poor. My best friend in high school was the son of the local undertaker, and he had lots of money. So I said I would be an undertaker. That did not go over big with anybody. Somebody said, why don't you be a druggist? If you said that to a kid today, they'd think you wanted to be a pusher or something like that. But off I went to school to study pharmacy. If you can picture me enjoying counting pills all day, not at all. But there I was at Wayne State University in Detroit, and one day I saw a sign that said that there was going to be a radio workshop at a certain time and place. Well, I had a broken radio and wanted to learn how to fix it. I kid you not. So off I went to this radio workshop, which of course did not have anything to do with fixing radios. Thank God I didn't take the radio with me, you know? It was, of course, about putting on radio programs, and it was taught by the guy who played the role of the sheriff on The Lone Ranger, which was coming out of Detroit in those days. 15 minutes of that was like hormones in the blood. You never quite recover from it. Example two of things not turning out quite as I expected them to. Well, I guess that was the right beginning, because in 1973, CPB noticed that there were almost no women in public broadcasting. So they appointed a group of men to figure out what was going on. And what was the right solution for this? So there was this big task force on women in broadcasting charged with figuring out what to do about it. And I was appointed to that task force. And I guess we came up with some results, because now look what we've got. I mean, we've got Dana Rehm, Judy Jankowski, Patty Cahill, and a host of others, luminaries. In any event, that sort of started me off on the business of being involved in national affairs. And about 1974, someone said, you ought to get elected to the NPR board. And I was. I was talking to Dale Utz about this the other day. Between the two of us, we have about 55 years of service on the NPR board. I told him he really ought to pay attention more to the kind of people he was hanging around with, and so should I. In any event, I wound up as the chairman of the finance committee. And I must tell you, I didn't know much about finance. Oh, I'd been to law school and all that sort of thing, but that didn't have much to do with finance per se. I survived the experience, and a little bit later, after my term had ended, I was asked to come back on the board because the financial situation was a little rocky. This was late 70s, I would say. And again became chairman of the finance committee. I discovered that the NPR staff and I were not quite on the same line. I had decreed that there would be no deficit spending. And if you paid attention to the minutes of the board, there wasn't any deficit spending. And that's because they had two sets of books. One set which the board got to look at, and one set that was the reality of the situation. Upon discovering this, we soon had a new chief financial officer. I survived that experience. It didn't turn out exactly as I thought either. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, NPR was in somewhat of a difficulty, and I was doing what one ought to be doing, which is, say, managing a station, and was called to come back to NPR and be on the finance committee. Well, I arrived in Washington, and I sort of looked over things, and by the next day, I was the chairman of the finance committee. I continued to look at things, and I wrote a memo to the board saying, you don't have a financial problem, you have a board problem. And by the next day, I was the chairman of the board, which I consider, you know, one of the major fast ascensions of our time. I had really wanted to be Pope, but my wife told me that there must be some reason why I wouldn't be. I have two phones on my desk. A secretary once asked me, what is that second phone for? I said, that's so the Pope can call me for moral advice. She says, it doesn't ring often, does it? In any event, some of you, at least, are familiar with the problems that NPR went through. And when I became the chairman under those circumstances, we were within 24 hours of pulling the plug. We hired a firm of lawyers who were remarkably experienced at bankrupt railroads, which I thought was an appropriate background, firm of Werner Lipford, as I recall, to draw up bankruptcy papers. I suggested that they do it in two forms. One is Chapter 11, which holds off your creditors while you figure out what to do. And the other was Chapter 7, which simply says we give up, liquidate the company, and that's the end of that. We needed money. Things were extremely tight. We would have negotiation sessions to try and borrow money. I was negotiating most of the night, and then the board would meet in the morning when I was about half dead, and I wanted to have some things written down for the board to look at and discuss. But there was no copy paper and no money to buy copy paper. Fortunately, we were located across the street from CBS, and the secretaries went across the street and borrowed copy paper from CBS so our board could look at the numbers. The issue really was, who would give us the money to keep operating? We didn't have the money to meet a payroll. Ron Bornstein had been asked to be the chief operating officer. And he and I connected very well because we both went to school at the University of Michigan at the same time back in the 50s and 60s. And we were quite an interesting team. We went down to the Riggs Bank to borrow some money. We said we need $2 million immediately to put into a company that is essentially bankrupt, has no assets, and we have no idea how bad the situation is because the books are a shambles. They gave us the $2 million and a coffee cup. You know, I don't know where that coffee cup is. We were able to keep things going for about another 30 days with that $2 million. Those of you who remember those times remember that every afternoon we had what we then called a closed circuit, where I talked with station managers about where we were and what the strategy would be and how we were going to get till the next day and what our lawyers were recommending. We were negotiating with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for money, like we needed $25 million. CPB wanted some security, like the distribution system, which was the only asset we had. We determined that it was not in the best interest of our member stations to give up the distribution system. And so we very rapidly formed a group of trustees, very, very prominent citizens. Elliot Richardson, for example, was one of them, and put the distribution system in trust for the stations. And that's why it is today a separate division, and why the stations jointly have been able to control it for so many years. The negotiations did not go well. Went on every night for a long, long time. But finally, I was able to sign a note for, I believe, $22 million. Now the question then became how to pay back that money. NPR did not have the money to pay back. And so I went to all of you and suggested that the stations would have to come up with a special assessment. And you gave it to us. We supported each other by coming up with about $25 million over a period of a couple of years to pay back the CPB loan, to, in effect, buy out and support National Public Radio. There was a picture of me in Broadcasting Magazine signing that document, and I thought to myself, will I become infamous for this? You bailed me out. I felt much better about that. But again, it was one of those circumstances in which one takes the responsibility of being on the board and not knowing exactly how things are going to turn out or even what the problems are going to be. I got to tell you, it was kind of interesting to try and find a new president for National Public Radio. Wouldn't you like to come and be the head of this organization that doesn't know yet what its books look like, and which has serious problems, and Congress is ready to fry us and all that sort of thing? I must say I did not enjoy going up in front of Congress and having to testify on this subject and being grilled by Mr. Dingell's oversight committee. There was one fortunate circumstance. Mr. Dingell's home constituency was a small town in Michigan where I grew up. And he was, in fact, my senator for a long time. So we had something in common, and I guess that took some of the heat off. Well, let me bring you sort of up to date by saying that after that time, it was necessary to change the financial arrangements in this system. To that point, the money had flowed from CPB to NPR, essentially buying the programs, which of course gave the financial providers a lot of control over what was produced and what wasn't produced. But it also failed to connect NPR to what I view as its primary constituency, the stations. So a group of us developed a totally different business plan, whereby the money would flow from CPB to the stations, and the stations then would pay NPR. For that time, that was the right solution. But I remember chairing a meeting in a hotel in Denver that was the longest meeting in the history of public broadcasting. I kid you not. I knew that if we didn't get a vote on changing the business plan, the discussion would go on forever. And so I told the people there, the people who are like you are, authorized representatives, that no one could leave the room until we had a vote. We would bring in food and troughs in the aisles if necessary, but no one would leave until we had a vote. The discussion went on, I believe, for 6 hours. And then we had a vote. And I think it was something like 189-4. And I felt pretty good about that. But one of the consequences of that decision, which, as I say, I think was right for that moment, was that it put NPR in the position of having customers. You were the customers. I was the customer. At last, they had to pay attention, and the stations had some measure of control, and things couldn't get out of hand too much financially. But it fostered a certain sense of imperialism in Washington. We'll produce, you pay. We'll tell you what's right, you get it on the air. So we had come from a position of what I'll call appropriate mistrust to a position of the customer relationship. In an environment in which the empire was in Washington, people thought that the best thing that could happen was to get one of their stories on NPR. Just couldn't get anybody to listen to those stories and get them on the air. Maybe that was the wrong goal. We've grown through that. We've come past that. Unfortunately, in more recent times, there was another discussion that I consider somewhat pernicious. The question was, is NPR a membership organization or is it some other kind of animal? And a small group of your board members met at the Capital City Brewing Company one night and decided that that was a closed discussion, that this is a membership organization and that we intended to see that it continued. Subsequently, that decision was off the table. And it was determined that, yes, this is a membership organization. And you got a new president who really understood that, one who recognized the necessity of consulting with the stations, one who recognized the importance of the core of NPR's business as journalism. We've grown past that, too. I'd like to argue that we have at last come from a customer relationship to a partnership. And that's what this meeting really is all about. But I suggest that, from a legal perspective anyway, a partnership consists of parties who mutually contribute something to the enterprise, who share the potential profits, and who share the potential risks, who trust each other, and who are willing to be honest with each other, and who in the long run recognize their common duty and common purpose. That's where we are today. The question in my mind is, it's very easy as we read the things on the screen to say these are the things we want NPR to do. But maybe there's another question yet to be asked. What do we bring to the table other than some money and a transmitter? What's our part of the bargain? What's our part of our contribution to this whole business of the partnership enterprise? That's a discussion that we need to carry on in the future, and I intend to raise that issue with the regionals and to have some more consultation about how we can make it more explicit and certain. Well, my term on the NPR board ends in November, and I want to thank you all for your trust and your cooperation through some really tough times. Thank you.